Last time I was here, a couple of weeks ago, I spoke about wise view, and tonight I'll be speaking about wise intention. And so, just so we make sure that we're on the same page here, we'll talk a little bit about these two factors and their place on the path. They're part of one of, if not the central teachings in Buddhism, the Four Noble Truths. The fourth noble truth is the well, first noble truth is the truth of dukkha, the second, the cause of dukkha, the third, the possibility of the end of dukkha, that the end of dukkha is possible in this moment, and the fourth is the way to the end of dukkha, which is the Noble Eightfold Path, right view, right intention, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, and right concentration. And these eight factors are split into three groupings or bundles or buckets, sila, samadhi, and panya. And this is part of the panya or wisdom grouping there, which is made up of wise view and wise intention. And since those are the first two factors, why does their grouping come last? Well, we do need some amount of wise view and wise intention to get started in the practice, but then they come to fulfillment at the end of the path, with the kind of stages of awakening there. So right or wise intention. Really, you can use either term. The Pali is samma sankappa. Sometimes sankappa is translated as thought. The Buddha was not the only person who taught about karma or kamma in Pali. It was a common thing that spiritual teachers in different spiritual traditions spoke of at the time of the Buddha. But what was distinct for him is that he talked about not just the action or kamma, but the intention, the motivation behind that action. What's the impetus for that action being done? And of course, when the Buddha was speaking about action, it was not just, the building the hut or selling something or growing crops. There were actions of body, actions of speech, and actions of mind. So there are three kinds of wrong intention. We'll start there and then move on to the wise ones. The three kinds of wrong intention are greed, ill will, harmfulness. We've heard these before, right? The three wise intentions are direct counters to these. So the counter to greed is renunciation or restraint. The counter to ill will is goodwill or kindness or metta. The counter to harmfulness is harmlessness, which of course is going to be, and at the time of the Buddha, as I spoke about, I think either the last time or a couple times ago, the absence of a quality. Harmlessness, taking away all harm, also implied the blossoming or the flowering of the opposite quality, so of compassion there. Last time I mentioned the Buddha before awakening divided his thoughts into two kinds, one kind leading to harm for himself, harm for others, obstructing wisdom, and leading away from nibbana. And then the other kind being beneficial, leading to wisdom and leading toward nibbana. So, thoughts or any actions, but certainly thoughts based on wrong intention lead to harm for ourselves, for others. They obstruct our wisdom and lead away from the path. Whereas the opposite, any thoughts that we have based on wise intention would be beneficial, lead to wisdom and toward nibbana. And we get all kinds of mind states, states of mind and heart. I remember many years ago, Philip was teaching what was then San Rafael Sangha at Turtle Island in San Rafael. It's the first place that Philip taught at Sangha. And I think the I it wasn't like the first year or something like that, but it was sometime in the early years. And I was renting in San Rafael in the Gerstle Park neighborhood. And though myself and my girlfriend at the time hadn't known it when we moved in, the owner of our property, we'd done everything through the manager, the owner of the property was in prison for child molestation, for multiple counts of child molestation. We mostly went work through the property manager, but there were times when we would interact with him via email or with the manager as intermediary. And he was a difficult person for both of us, I think. And I don't remember what the precipitating incident was in this story that I'm going to tell, but something happened and we felt hurt and angry at how he handled it and angry with him. And I can't remember what the topic was at Sangha that night, but somehow it was relevant enough for me to ask a question about this situation that we were dealing with. I was very angry and judgmental of the landlord. I spoke of that pretty clearly. And one of the things that Philip said in response to me is that at that moment, it might be hard to tell my mind-heart state from my landlord's. I was quite taken aback by that. I did not like that comparison at all. But that is a very skillful Dhamma teaching, I think. We had enough history with each other at that point. But did I want to cultivate the first kind of thoughts, or did I want to exercise my choice, my wise intention, and cultivate the second type of thoughts? Totally separate from whether I or we stood up for ourselves with our landlord. But really pointing to that we have some measure of choice around this much of the time. Going to read an excerpt from a book by Venerable Bodhi, Bhikkhu Bodhi, The Noble Eightfold Path, The Way to the End of Suffering. Understanding the four truths in relation to one's own life, the four noble truths in relation to one's own life, gives rise to the intention of renunciation. Understanding them in relation to other beings gives rise to the other two right intentions. When we see how our own lives are pervaded by dukkha and how this dukkha derives from craving, the mind inclines to renunciation, to abandoning craving and the objects to which it binds us. Then, when we apply the truths in an analogous way to other living beings, the contemplation nurtures the growth of goodwill and harmlessness. We see that, like ourselves, all other living beings want to be happy, and again that, like ourselves, they're subject to suffering, to dukkha. The consideration that all beings seek happiness causes thoughts of goodwill to arise, the loving wish that they be well, happy, and peaceful. The consideration that beings are exposed to suffering causes thoughts of harmlessness to arise, the compassionate wish that they be free from suffering. And then skip just a little bit. Since greed and aversion are deeply grounded, they do not yield easily. However, the work of overcoming them is not impossible if an effective strategy is employed. The path devised by the Buddha makes use of an indirect approach. It proceeds by tackling the thoughts to which these defilements give rise. Greed and aversion surface in the form of thoughts, and thus can be eroded by a process of thought substitution, by replacing them with the thoughts opposed to them. The intention of renunciation provides the remedy to greed. Greed comes to manifestation in thoughts of desire, as sensual, acquisitive, and possessive thoughts. Thoughts of renunciation spring from the wholesome root of non-greed, which they activate whenever they are cultivated. Thoughts of goodwill counter the former outflow of aversion, thoughts of harmlessness, the latter outflow, in this way excising the unwholesome root of aversion itself. So this is possible for us, possible for all of us. I'm going to speak a bit about these three wise intentions, and more about renunciation. I think that's the one that gets less attention. The Pali word for that is nekamma. It doesn't have any similar root to the word kamma, which means action or karma. The English word renunciation can be a difficult word for us. Gil Fronsdal's description of this word, he said, no, the renunciation doesn't really get at it. It's like, this is like, imagine you were in a one-room cabin for the winter, snowed in all winter long with your whole family, and then the spring thaw came and you got to go outside. So a little, it kind of turns it on its head a bit there, but gives you some idea of the sense of relief and ease that can come with this activity. Another possible translation for this word might be restraint, such as the restraint of the precepts. I think most of us here know that hurting other beings doesn't feel good. Right? When we cause harm, we know taking what's not freely offered, deliberately cutting in line of others, or taking three of the half dozen brownies at the potluck when there are 15 people behind us in line. We know what it's going to feel like if we have to sit with that after the fact, right? We know that saying things, all of us know many times, we've said things that aren't true, or that were harsh, or that turned somebody against somebody else. And we know what it's like to sit with that. We may even know, though, actually, I think for the precept around not using intoxicants, which cloud the mind, I don't believe that that necessarily has anything wrong with it ethically, except that it makes us prone to acting in those other ways that do cause harm, or acting in ways that are foolish. Restraint or renunciation also points directly to the middle path, as the Buddha taught. The middle path. So that's the finding the middle ground between the life of sensual indulgence, right, which is these days is known as Amazon.com, right? That's one of its names, or TikTok or Instagram or Facebook, the endless scrolling, looking for something good. That's on the side of gratifying the senses. And then on the other side was the life of asceticism that the Buddha practiced for many years before turning away from that, before he became fully enlightened. To quote Philip, the Eightfold Path invites us to view our lives as practice rather than as endless moments of trying to get what we want. Boy, isn't that true, huh? So, not the endless moments of trying to get what we want, but also not being ascetic. And yet the skillfulness, the usefulness for ourselves, how helpful it is for ourselves to place some boundaries, some limitations around our behavior, and the usefulness of having some kind of ethical compass. As we continue to practice with this over time, we start to be able to verify it, right? We get the verification. It's actually true. Huh. And then one Sangha member was saying a couple of weeks ago about just seeing, seeing the mind's compulsion to maybe even go at herself with harsh speech, internal speech, but just kind of seeing through that and then just dropping that and letting that go. It's not that we want to be careful about not using it as a way to judge ourselves or compare ourselves, which I think we do so frequently. judging, comparing, and fixing. But we, if you say fewer harsh things or snarky things or slightly mean things, or if your mind gets calmer, then deeper states of meditation are more readily available to us. There is definitely a feedback loop at play here. As Bhikkhu Bodhi says in his book or booklet on the Noble Eightfold Path, to understand desire, or Ajahn Sumedho might say the attachment to desire, to understand the attachment to desire in such a way that we can loosen its hold, we need to see that desire is invariably bound up with dukkha. Not in badness, but in that unsatisfactoriness. When we go chasing the tail, the dog chasing its tail. So that's the wise intention of renunciation. The wise intention of metta, of goodwill. Yeah, that's how some people translate it. Kindness, loving kindness. Venerable Anālayo has said he thinks the word that's closest to metta in English is benevolence. It's nice. P sometimes calls it friendliness or friendness, maybe, I think. This opposes ill will. Can we open to other beings and wish them well? Can we open to ourselves and wish ourselves well? Philip often talks about the committee, right? Those internal voices that we have that are always speaking up and that, do this, no, do that. Da-da-da. We end up in this battle with ourselves. As he says, when talking about that difficult committee member, love that part up. Love that committee member up. We don't want to judge that one or compare it or fix it or make it bad. Oh, sweetheart, it's all right. We don't want to give it the keys to the car. That's an accident waiting to happen. So what helps us to do this? Whatever reflections you can use that help you are useful. Seeing how all beings have gotten to be the way they are through a series of events, through the unfolding of a lifetime, through their own actions. Seeing how, just as the sun shines on all plants, both the fruit trees and the vegetables and the invasive plants, the weeds, all beings are worthy of kindness and goodwill. We can let our kindness and goodwill radiate towards all beings. Another common one, seeing how just as we wish to be happy, so all beings wish to be happy. The wise intention of ahimsa, which is non-harming or compassion. This is the intention of cultivating those thoughts of caring, of getting to replace our cruel, the mean thoughts, possibly even violent thoughts, with thoughts of compassion. Replacing is very useful and can be really foundational to the deepening of practice. All beings face dukkha and its cause. That's true, right? Yeah, as near as we can tell. Seeing how all beings have parents, all beings got to be this way somehow. We can use that reflection that way. Seeing how all beings wish to be free of dukkha. Is that not true? And the deep understanding when we get to that point where, with practice, we have a moment where we pause. And that deep understanding that we don't want to be a cause of greater harm as best we're able. And in this moment, at least, we get to make that choice. It's only in this moment that we get to make that choice. So, comments, questions, thoughts. I have a bit more, but I want to take a pause here. They don't have to be comments or thoughts or questions. We will keep on keeping on. Oh, Nancy, please.
Okay. So, Art, as you've been talking, I've been thinking about, I just spent the last 4 days up in the mountains with some friends at her cabin. And you talk about snarky thoughts and snarky words and snarky reactions. She would get snarky. My friend and I, both practitioners, I would sometimes get snarky back. My friend did not. And and at the moment, you know, having that renunciation of not being snarky back didn't even occur to me. Later, I apologized for getting snarky. I wasn't nearly as snarky as she was, but I was, and I was tired, and I don't know, as I'm listening to you, I'm finding myself thinking, how can I rein in snarky when I feel that I'm being snarked at?
I think with practice, that's one way to do it. Maybe you take snarkiness as something that is going to be something you're going to pay closer attention to,
you know,
for X amount of time. And then you look at that and you see, and maybe you journal on it, or you have a Dharma buddy who you talk with occasionally and you do your snark check-in with them. How's the snarkiness been lately? Oh, actually, I had like a few moments where I stopped myself. And that's probably would be more useful to see, is to start to see more of those moments where you did not cultivate that.
And I have someone coming to visit me soon who I can really get triggered by. So I do want to take this on as a practice. So thank you for the conversation.
Yeah.
And I want to love up that part of the committee and get a little better at this. Okay.
And not judging them or fixing them, and not judging or comparing or fixing yourself. Okay.
Okay.
We're cultivating, as best we're able, as Philip would say, we're cultivating wise intention. We're not cultivating aversion.
Okay.
Because you know the feel of those. You know the difference between those, how they feel.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. Sure.
And over time.
Okay. Yeah. Thanks very much.
And Kylie, do you have a question?
More a comment, but I just love what you said about the feedback loop. And that's what I'm noticing with deepening practice. Not so much, like I still get snarky and reactive, but I'm noticing there's more space, certainly less negative self-talk after the fact, and more loving kindness around the conditioning and everything that's led up to the snarkiness, but also more space to make choices. And I'm finding doing body practices really, really helpful in that space, because rather than going into my cluttered mind, I go into my body and I feel, where am I feeling this reactivity? And sometimes instead of a snarky response, I'll just say, oh, I'm feeling so reactive now. And that's what I'll say to my children or my partner if they trigger me, or if I'm feeling triggered, I'll just say, oh, I'm feeling very reactive right now. And they'll go, oh, okay, interesting. So it just gives me that that space.
Yeah.
To and I can see that change, and it's so incredibly hopeful for me. I love it. Thank you.
It's really wonderful when we start to see that and start to see all of a sudden we have those fork in the road moments. It's like, oh, wow. I have choice here. I have some measure of choice, right? Not perfect choice, but yeah, thank you for that. When I was a... Oh, Bill, please.
Barbara just said, you always snark the ones you love.
Yeah, so interesting to notice like how that may happen there. And is there just...
Well, it's something that I have had to work on a lot over the years. And I've found a lot of liberation in those moments when I have the freedom to not be snarky. And then I'm actually not snarky. It's liberating. But I just recently had a conversation with a member of the family who is very snarky to me. And it's still, and for most people now, I don't have that snark. And I really find it very liberating. But I just realized a recent conversation with a family member who is very snarky with me, and it triggers my snark. And this is a pattern that goes way back. So I'm realizing I can't, you know, yes, I can pat myself on the back for the progress I've made, but I still have a lot to work on.
Opportunities are many, aren't they? And I do think, it's really useful to reflect on the times when you've made a different choice, because it's noticeable, that the change in you is noticeable, right? And very, I know
much,
that,
very much so.
Yeah. And I know that has fed your practice, your formal practice in some ways that have been very useful to you as well. So it's, you know, we were just talking about the feedback loop there. Yeah, so useful. So, okay, I'll continue on. When I was a novice monk in Burma, I had to take the 10 precepts, and we had to retake them every week. I didn't like going to the meetings. They were rote. They were kind of unfulfilling. They didn't meet with my ideas of what the Dhamma was about, my limited ideas of what the Dhamma was about at that point in time. They were also in the evening, so it was after dark, meaning I had to walk back to my kuti, my hut. It was, you know, about a 10-minute walk up the hill in this trail in the dark. I had a flashlight, but like the batteries were, Burmese batteries are really poor quality, so the light beam was really dull. It was often raining. The trails are basically like the stream beds because they're slightly lower than the surrounding area. So you can get some idea of aversion going on there. So I would have an interview with the abbot every day. And what we would do is we would report on our practice in the previous day, and then we got to ask a question. And I was kind of getting bored and didn't feel like formal sitting meditation was not going anywhere. And I was getting bored, so... the toilet in my kuti in my hut was in the floor. It was, you know, you'd squat on either side of it. There's like these ceramic foot pads kind of thing you would stand on or squat on. There were the ants that came to that toilet to get water. Some would invariably get lost in the water. Some would invariably get flushed down if I just poured water in, or if I used the scrubber or something like that. And so I asked the abbot one day when I was kind of bored. I had run out of other interesting topics to ask him, or maybe it was very fortuitous, actually. And I asked him, I'm not responsible for these ants that go into the toilet and then die when I flush it, right? Or when the scrubber gets them? And he's like, yes, you are. I was like, what am I supposed to do? He's like, well, maybe you take the scrubber and you pull them out before you flush. And I was just quite, I had reactive thoughts to that. But slowly, gradually, out of with curiosity and with interest, I started to pay closer and closer, more and more refined attention to what my mind heart state was like toward the ants. From one of just like outright disdain, when I started to pay close attention to it, it was not a wholesome reaction towards them. My mind state was not wholesome. It was quite unwholesome, cultivating anger, judgment, hateful thoughts. And then I started to pay closer attention, I started to notice what kind of my mind-heart state was in towards other beings, towards other creatures. The rats that lived in the attic of my little hut, the big spiders, they had these big, fast spiders there that kind of freaked me out much of the time. All kinds of other creatures there. Then it was much more about just kind of really, not even about the creatures out there, but it was just whatever in whatever situation, about my mind and heart. What was my mind and heart? So at first I was retaking the precepts once a week, but if you knew that you had broken the precepts, you were supposed to go to your preceptor. For me, that was the abbot, and renew them. And so I started like renewing the precepts with him before the week was up. Then I'd be renewing them after 5 days, and then after 4 days, and then until I just retake them every day or 2 days or 3 days, something like that. At that point, he was not concerned about me coming to the evening weekly meetings where I had to renew the precepts. He was fine if I didn't come, because he could tell that I was actively engaged with them. He could tell that it was a living practice for me. It gave me, and of course, so I didn't have to go to those meetings, but of course I benefited the most from that, right? That purification. They talk about one of the commentaries in the Theravadin practice is called the path of purification, the Visuddhimagga. It is a path of purification. Over time, it works. It gave me a greater sense of ease. It led directly to a place where my practice had kind of crashed, and I had no concentration. I couldn't stay with the breath for more than half a breath at a time. And then the mind and heart started to settle down over time as I did this. So renouncing is not rejecting. It comes from an open-hearted kindness, the wish for the well-being of others. As Bhikkhu Bodhi says, the Buddha says that whatever one reflects upon frequently becomes the inclination of the mind. If one frequently thinks sensual, hostile, or harmful thoughts, desire, ill will, and harmfulness become the inclination of the mind. If one frequently thinks in the opposite way, renunciation, goodwill, and harmlessness become the inclination of the mind. The direction we take always comes back to ourselves, to the intentions we generate moment by moment in the course of our lives. So we can all, in our modest ways, very modest ways, let wise view and wise intention be more part of our ethical compass. We can engage with them more as in our lived practice as we go through our days. Thank you for your attention. Are there any comments or questions? Okay. Corey, please.
just want to say I really appreciated the discussion of a different idea of what renunciation means and sort of flipping it like that. It reminds me of Peter Gabriel once said that his best work was when he had the least instruments and the least of all these other, like the more it's constrained, the recording situation was constrained. He only had a few instruments and he had to, you know, a short amount of time that he could produce the most creative work ever. And it sort of kind of reminds me of that in a way. So
maybe it goes like me, then maybe I can get to the Peter Gabriel stage and then the first stage of awakening or second, third, fourth, something like that. I don't know. Let's see.